You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Glenn Greenwald, author of No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state on Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state. Also on the program for members, we'll include an interview, a short interview I did with David Dayan on Ring of Fire the other day. We are mixing it up a little bit in terms of our live show today, as Greenwald is out of the country and our timing is a little bit different. But also on the program today, as bills are offered to essentially inhumanely ship these children who are seeking asylum in this country out of this country as quickly as possible. Jose Vargas, the Pulitzer Award-winning journalist who essentially outed himself, if you will, as a so-called illegal immigrant, I guess now almost 3 years ago, has been detained in Texas. More on that story as we continue on the program. A bill appears to be in the works and offered today on temporarily funding the Highway Trust Fund, which of course will end up screwing workers in some fashion or another down the road. And good news out of Chicago, it take it for what it's worth. Rahm Emanuel looks like he's certainly vulnerable to a challenge as a mayor of that city. Meanwhile, the shelling continues in Israel and Gaza. Israel this morning accepted a ceasefire proposal by Egypt. Gaza, Hamas, I should say, apparently did not. And the bombardment by Israel continues, as does that by Hamas. Nearly 200 dead in 200 dead Palestinians at this point. Apparently 70% or so are civilians, and somewhere around 40 or 50% of those are children. You can do the math, but not sure how necessary it is. The DOJ settles with Citigroup, and this one's not just a sham, but may in fact be a huge fig leaf for Citibank. We will dig into that as well. And then a couple of the Texas voting case launches today, and a federal judge rejects Florida's redistricting. We will touch on that as well. I will take your phone calls earlier in today's program. We will be talking to Glenn Greenwald. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Glenn Greenwald, author of the, well, I guess his most recent of multiple New York Times bestsellers, but author of the most recent No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. Glenn, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Yes, I consider myself a Majority Report regular.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you do. Now, all right. There's been a couple of stories as of late, obviously, that have come out that I want to get your take on and ask you about. And let's start first with, there was a story that Bart Gellman had, which preceded a big one that you released on The Intercept. But that was that we found that Edward Snowden, unlike what the NSA had told us, not only had access to, I guess, the reports about NSA surveillance, but he had access to the actual intercepts themselves. Aside from the fact that it was clear that the NSA was lying about what access Snowden have, what are the implications of that in general? Just that Edward Snowden as to who he was in the NSA system had access to these actual intercepts.
Right. Well, there were two aspects that the Washington Post highlighted, which is, number one, they did an analysis, and it turned out that 9 out of 10 messages intercepted by the NSA were actually sent by non-targets of the NSA as opposed to the actual targets. Collection that they do in trying to collect on their targets ends up 90% being about non-targets. And secondly, and I've known this for a long time and actually said this a few months ago, the NSA not only collects but then retains in their files, because we have them, some of the most intimate, sexual, private, personal communications, photographs, chats, and the like that you could possibly imagine. I mean, things that have absolutely no remote connection to terrorism or national security. But the broader point, the one that you're asking about from this story and from the fact that Snowden had these documents, is the one that I think is actually probably more important, which is the primary defense of the NSA over the last year and its various apologists and defenders has been, oh, you need not worry about this extraordinarily potent, pervasive surveillance system that we've constructed where we collect all of this massive amount of your private communication, because there's all these really rigorous controls that prevent any kind of abuse. And yet here was somebody, Edward Snowden, who didn't even work for the NSA. He was an outside contractor working for Booz Allen and then prior to that the Dell Corporation, who had not only had access to the most intimate personal private communications collected by the NSA, but obviously was able to access them, read them, and even take them in huge quantities without the NSA having any idea that he was doing it. And I think it just underscores how frivolous is this claim that the system that has 90,000 employees working within it, both contractors and direct employees, is remotely safe and secure.
I mean, that is the part, and I think that, you know, I asked you this a year ago when we spoke as well. If the NSA was either lying to everybody, and it was a very bad lie, because obviously these would ultimately be reported on if they knew that Snowden had the access to these intercepts. If they didn't know, then what about all the other potential people who may have taken information not for the purpose of whistleblowing, but for, I don't know, blackmailing or selling this information? How could they possibly be aware that there were other people or not taking this information if they didn't even know about the guy who admitted he took them?
Well, here's the thing. So obviously they had no idea that Snowden was taking all of this as he took it, right? Or they would have stopped him. So that's indisputably true, that he accessed all of this extremely sensitive, raw communications and then took it without them having any idea that he did it. So imagine how easy it is to take, say, one person's communications without detection when he was able to take tens of thousands. The Washington Post counted it as 160,000 emails that he took without detection. But the really important point is that they still have absolutely no idea what he took. And occasionally, in candid moments, they actually admit that. Keith Alexander, just a month ago, the longtime chief of the NSA who resigned several months ago, admitted in an interview that they really have no idea what Edward Snowden took. And yet, they've spent tens of millions of dollars to try and find out. That's how poorly managed this system is, that even when they know somebody has taken hundreds of thousands of documents right under their noses, they're incapable of finding out, of figuring out what it is that that person took. So as you say, imagine somebody who takes far less and who never identifies themselves because they're taking it for blackmail or to sell it or just for vengeance or personal curiosity or all the other things that we know people within spying systems do to abuse those powers. It is inconceivable that the NSA would have the foggiest idea that these people were doing it. And when I talked to Edward Snowden in Hong Kong, and he pretty much said this in the very first interview that I did with him that we published online, he said that a primary motive for him deciding to become a whistleblower and to take all of this information was because of how few controls there are on this system. And he famously said that any analyst sitting at a desk like he was doing, who had access to programs like XKeyscore and others that tens of thousands of people throughout the intelligence community have access to, could simply, by knowing somebody's personal email address, even the President of the United States, read all of their emails. And there's no supervisory control, there's no auditing control, there's very little effort, even after the fact, to detect that level of abuse. And that probably more than anything is what really disturbed him and made him come forward. And I think his own conduct has proven how valid those concerns are.
All right, let's move to your latest piece that you wrote with Murtaza Hussein in The Intercept. You essentially named names. You listed five American citizens who have been surveilled by the NSA. None of them have been charged with anything. Just walk us through why those five. How many others are you aware of?
Well, we have a list of roughly 7,000 email addresses, not names of people, but email addresses, which were put under surveillance by some combination of the FBI and the NSA. And in most of those cases, it is impossible to identify who the person is who's the user of email. I mean, they'll say, you know, greentree473@yahoo.com. It's not possible to find out who that person is because there's no public record of that email address and it doesn't in any way indicate their name and their position. In a small percentage of cases, the list does identify the name of the person who is the owner of the email address. And then in a few other cases, small percentage of the cases, we were able to identify it ourselves by matching the email address to the person's name or to their publicly identified means of contact and then confirming with those people that they were actually the person who used the email address. So in a very small percentage of those 7,000 email address cases, we were able to identify the people who were the users of that email address. In some of those cases, it seemed as though that was the kind of surveillance most people would consider valid because they're people who have long been accused of being hardcore members of designated terrorist organizations. In other cases where they don't seem to have any connection to terrorism, they're private people who simply did not want to be named because they were very worried that if we named them as an NSA target, that would forever stigmatize them. The NSA would come out and say, which is what they said, which is, the only people who we're allowed to target are people who the FISA court concludes are not only agents of a foreign power or a terrorist organization, but are engaged in espionage or terrorism on behalf of those organizations. And they didn't want to be publicly stigmatized in that way. I mean, obviously, if you're an American Muslim, that stigma is particularly damaging. But even for people who aren't, it can be very damaging. So there were a lot of people who just didn't want to be named. And then there were people who we identified who were very newsworthy as targets because there's zero evidence that they've ever engaged in wrongdoing. They engage in the kind of political dissent and activism that made surveillance in the 1960s and 70s so scandalous and who were willing to be named. And so we picked five of them, in part because we wanted the reporting to be manageable, and in part because those are the people that we thought were newsworthy and who were willing to be named, and we proceeded to do the reporting on those five people.
And give me your sense of, I mean, it opens up a lot of issues in terms of First Amendment implications. I mean, what do we know in terms of the justification that the NSA has for surveilling these five, all of whom are Muslim Americans? What do we know in terms of their justification and the implications on the First Amendment? I mean, I'm talking specifically about their associations, because it seems the NSA explicitly said that, you know, we don't surveil anybody for protest, but they certainly seem to ignore that part of the First Amendment about free association.
Well, first of all, we don't know very much at all about the NSA's justification because the entire process takes place in complete secrecy. The FISA court itself meets in total secrecy. Only the government is permitted to attend. We don't see any of the court rulings about what kinds of evidence is required in order to get a warrant. And the NSA refused to talk to us in any specific way about why these people were surveilled or what the alleged justification is. What was really interesting was the statement that the NSA issued in response to our story, in which they said a person's political views and activism is not sole, is that we don't, that is not a sole factor. That cannot solely determine whether or not they are targeted for surveillance, and the implication of that is consistent with what sources told us who have worked in the context of the FISA process we quoted in the story, which is that a person's political views is a significant factor. It may not be by itself sufficient. They may say they need other things, but certainly if a person has certain ideas, criticisms of the U.S. government, or they have, as you say, certain associations or engage in certain kinds of activism, that can trigger serious attention by the U.S. government that then leads to full-blown surveillance. And, you know, I think that the really important point about this is we like to idealize things that have happened in the past. You know, I notice this all the time when people talk about Daniel Ellsberg, and they talk about him as someone who everyone has to agree is this really noble, heroic whistleblower who did the right thing. I mean, even the harshest critics of Snowden won't attack Ellsberg because everybody just agrees that he did the right thing. Back in 1971, you know, 40 years ago, that wasn't at all the case. Huge numbers of people, probably majorities, believed that Ellsberg, they thought about him the way they talked about Snowden, that he was a Russian spy, that he had damaged American national security, that he had put the lives of people in uniform in harm's way, that he was reckless, that he was a traitor. And it's only 40 years later do we think about Daniel Ellsberg in this really, like, nice, clean, idealized way. The same exact thing is true of the COINTELPRO abuses and the surveillance abuses of the J. Edgar Hoover era. When we talk about targeting anti-war protesters or civil rights leaders or government critics on the right and the left with surveillance, we all now say, oh, of course that was totally wrong, because we have this idealized view of what those targets were. The reality is that there were elements in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement and in the government protest movements on the left and the right that were actually radical and disruptive, and in some cases even advocated for violence or for lawbreaking and engaged in lawbreaking. People back then considered those groups a serious threat and wanted them surveilled, wanted those groups monitored on the grounds that they were posing a serious disruption or challenge or threat to the status quo. That is exactly how American Muslims are viewed now. So lots of people in response to our story said, well, look, these people have some ideas that I really find upsetting or extreme or radical or whatever. They support the Palestinian movement, or they think that Ahmadinejad is not nearly as bad as we say, or they don't think Hamas and Hezbollah should be viewed as terrorist organizations, or they have these associations with these bad people. Exactly the same kind of mentality that resulted in the Hoover abuses of the 60s and 70s, and it's exactly the same kind of surveillance abuse. It's taking people who are marginalized because of their political views and who are viewed as threats because of their constitutionally protected political activism and subjecting them to surveillance. And it is impossible, in my view, to view the Hoover-era surveillance abuses as wrong while defending what's being done to Muslim American leaders of the type that we reported on.
Do you think that the impact, the way, and this is obviously, this may be a poor reflection on the state of our politics, but do you think that part of the reaction to who was being surveilled was not simply a function of what these folks have said, but simply because they're Muslim? In other words, is there also just simply a generic, well, you surveil all Muslims, response here?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, American history is pretty much defined by having one particular group, usually more than one, but certainly one particular group at least, and usually one at the sort of peak, that's viewed as the most marginalized, the most susceptible to valid forms of prejudice and discrimination, the group about which you're permitted to say things that you would not be allowed to say about any other group. And that group, for the last 12 years in the United States, has been American Muslims. I mean, obviously, African Americans have always occupied that position, more or less, as have immigrants and others. But American Muslims are, I'd say, the most marginalized group in the United States when it comes to certain kinds of political discourse and what we think is generally permissible. The reason that all kinds of extreme abuses on the part of the government have been tolerated over the last 12 years, from drones to invasions of countries to rendition and kidnapping to pervasive surveillance to putting people in prison for over a decade without even charging them with a crime, the reason that's all been tolerated is because of the perception that only Muslims are affected, and therefore we should either be indifferent about that or supportive of it. And that has been, you know, the mindset that continues, I think, to pervade American politics. And so, you know, I think there was a lot of excitement and anticipation of the story that we were going to publish because everyone had all kinds of fantasies about who we were going to name. And they thought we were going to name, you know, actual Americans, meaning, you know, non-Muslims, white
right.
people or famous journalists or politicians or whatever. And then when our story came out, I do think that a lot of the reaction was, oh, it's just Muslims. I mean, of course, not only are they being surveilled, but I have no problem with that. But, you know, I think it did make a big impact, in part because the five people that we named were so obviously not the kinds of people that the government has led the world to believe they target for surveillance. But I definitely think that there's a big, big faction within the Republican Party, and at least as big of a faction, if not bigger at this point in the Democratic Party, that views state abuses as perfectly legitimate, provided that they're confined to targeting Muslims. And so that definitely drove a big part of the reaction to the story, unquestionably.
Let me ask you a two-part question in terms of reform. Have you been, and when we last spoke, I think you were encouraged by the reaction that we were seeing in Congress. It seems to me that there is almost even more action in Congress than we're seeing in the general population in some respects in terms of intensity. Because like you say, I think there's part of the response is, you know, our government does this. These are Muslims. How do you count for the activity we're seeing within Congress versus the intensity of how people have reacted? And B, what would reform look like at this point? What do you think it should look like?
Well, first of all, I think the reason why this story has resonated around the world the way that it did, including domestically, is precisely because people understood for the first time that these abuses are not confined to Muslim Americans. I mean, the first story that we did, of course, was about the collection of all Americans' metadata. Had we led with the story that we just published about targeting the five Muslim Americans, I think the story would have been much more limited in impact. The reason that it was so, the impact was so large and that the debate was so intense and sustained for so long was not only because we led with the story about the collection of metadata of all Americans, but then immediately after about the PRISM program and the invasions into people's activities on Facebook and Google and Yahoo and Skype, which everyone around the world and lots of Americans use. And so people felt personally implicated in a way that they have rarely felt with these kinds of stories in the past. And so I think that's a big part of it, was that sense of this surveillance state undermines everybody's privacy, even normal people like me and not just these Muslims, has endured. I also think that a very big part of why there's a movement in Congress is because there is a very sizable percentage of the population, as reflected by public opinion polls, that show that people really are extremely concerned about and angry about this kind of spying, and politicians are reacting to that.
Don't you think there's another dynamic here? I mean, look, you know, 80 some odd percent of people don't want their Social Security cut, and a similar percentage would be okay with expanding benefits. But we don't see anybody who even raises that in Congress is immediately marginalized. Yet in this situation, while, yes, I think polls show that people are upset about it, there just doesn't seem to be, an intensity that would normally otherwise lead to this type of activity in Congress.
Well, I mean, look, I think, you know, first of all, I'm not sure how you measure that kind of intensity. In general, in the United States, people don't engage in street protest any longer,
right,
with very rare exception. You know, maybe people would go out into the street when they perceive that their economic futures are being jeopardized, as they did with things like the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement. I mean, although even those were pretty short-lived. I mean, there's not really a protest movement in the United States. People don't go out onto the streets. They certainly aren't going to go out into the streets for things like privacy invasions, things that are perceived as something a little bit remote and abstract and ethereal. But I do think, you know, you can judge politicians' behavior. You can judge public opinion by politicians' behavior. And you have candidates from both political parties running on a platform of opposition to the NSA. And I think the main, the one of the more interesting aspects of the story, and one of the most significant in answering your question about why there has been this movement in the NSA, is because it has not broken down along partisan lines. You have lots of liberals in the Democratic Party who have been consistently opposed to the abuses and excesses of the national security state, who just instinctively oppose this kind of secrecy and this kind of overreach. And then you have a big strain of the Republican Party, really two factions in the Republican Party, one kind of principled and one completely craven, the principled ones being the sort of libertarian Tea Party faction that also consistently, even under Bush, oppose this kind of surveillance, but they're a much bigger force now in the Republican Party because of the Tea Party movement. And then you have just sort of the partisan hacks who view it as a way of undermining Obama, who would be perfectly fine with this kind of surveillance if they were the Republican president and were fine with it under Bush. But you have a big part of the Republican Party and a big part of the Democratic Party joining together in a way that virtually never happens on an issue of serious contention. And I think their constituencies are the same way. If you look at polling data, in fact, there was a poll just the other day that asked Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, do you think the NSA spying powers have gone too far domestically? And it's like 66% of Republicans, 63% of Independents, and 49% of Democrats say that it's gone too far. When you had that bill to defund the NSA in Congress, the two primary sponsors were Justin Amash, the second-term young Tea Party conservative Republican from Michigan, and then John Conyers, the 25th-term African-American liberal from Detroit. And I think that signifies this kind of trans-ideological, trans-partisan coalition on this issue that has really driven it and made it enduring because it's insusceptible to the normal partisan kind of attacks that weaken any effort to undermine the status quo.
And so what would constitute reform, genuine reform in your mind?
So I don't, even though, you know, having said all the stuff I just said, I don't look at what's happening in Congress with any real degree of optimism, because I don't think that the best hope for limiting the powers of the U.S. government will come from the U.S. government. I don't think the U.S. government is going to go around unilaterally limiting its own powers in a meaningful way. You will have some bill that is called reform that the White House and the Dianne Feinsteins and John Boehners and the like will succeed in watering down to such an extent that it becomes reform in name only. And it'll let President Obama go before the world and give a pretty speech and say, we've heard your complaints and we've recalibrated the balance between privacy and security, and we have this beautiful reform bill that will really be designed to do nothing but placate public anger and allow the system to proceed more or less unimpeded, in fact, stronger than ever, because now there's a perception, an inaccurate one, but an enduring one, that it has been reformed. I don't think the changes are going to come from there. I think they're going to come from other places. I'm really optimistic about the coalition of countries that are working to create new physical structures and regulatory regimes that will undermine the ability of the U.S. to dominate the Internet. I'm super enthused about the real panic that U.S. tech giants like Facebook and Yahoo and Google are experiencing over fears that this surveillance system will destroy their future business opportunities, because 10-year-olds and 14-year-olds and, you know, adults are going to be really vulnerable to the appeal from Korean and Brazilian and German competitors that say, don't use those U.S. companies for your chatting and your email and your personal data, because they'll give it to the NSA and we won't. And, you know, I don't think the U.S. government does really care about polling data showing that people are angry about the NSA, but I do think they care about the views of Silicon Valley billionaires who really are worried about the effects of the spying regime on their future business interests. And I think that's going to be a meaningful pressure point. I also think those companies are going to want to prove to future users that they are serious about building walls between this data and the NSA that will make it much harder for the NSA to invade. And then ultimately, I really think the biggest change is going to come from individual user usage. If we go from having tens of thousands of people, as we have now, using serious encryption technology, where they build walls around their emails and their internet usage, to having 10 million people doing that, or to having that be the default means by which people use the internet and by which people communicate, that will put a very serious wall between the NSA and other intelligence agencies and the internet, and will make it much more difficult to turn the internet into this vast, limitless spying regime. I think that is a serious source of optimism.
So you don't think that any type of response like we may have seen from COINTELPRO has value or is possible? I mean,
well, look at what happened with those really intense. I mean, you not only had COINTELPRO, but you had the revelations about spying on Martin Luther King. You had the Nixon scandals of covert wiretapping. I mean, the height of political scandal over these issues. And you had the U.S. Congress doing what I just described, which is they said, oh, don't worry, we've now reformed the system. We've created this new court that the government has to go to, and they can never spy on you unless they get the permission of a court in order to do it. Now, that sounds like a great reform, but then they ended up building the court so it meets in secret, only one side gets to attend, and it became this total rubber-stamping court. So it was reform in theory, but it was completely illusory. It didn't really provide limits on what the government could do. So, you know, for me, Sam, the big question when we talk about reform is this one. This is the only question that matters is, are we going to have a government that engages in surveillance against specific individuals where there's evidence to believe they've engaged in some kind of behavior that merits the surveillance? Targeted surveillance. And you can debate what those standards might be. Does the person have to be an agent of a foreign power, engage in terrorism? How do you prove that? But that's targeted surveillance. They only monitor and collect data about specific individuals who have done something to merit the surveillance. Or are we going to have mass indiscriminate surveillance where the government can put entire populations of foreign countries and its own population under a microscope indiscriminately pursuant to a system of suspicionless surveillance where you don't have to do anything wrong, but the government is still collecting information about who you're talking to, about what you're doing on the internet? It is inconceivable to me that Congress will pass any kind of meaningful law that confines what the NSA and these other agencies can do simply to targeted surveillance. They still believe in the principle of indiscriminate mass surveillance, and as long as that's true, I don't think that reform will be meaningful. There can be some steps in the right direction, putting an advocate in the FISA court, no longer collecting all the metadata in the hands of the government, things like that that can actually make a decent size difference. But I think that the question of whether we're going to have a government engage in mass indiscriminate surveillance is not going to be answered by the Congress, but by those other pressure points I identified.
Okay, and so finally, when you reported on the Snowden revelations, at that time, I think it was Wyden who said that what we were seeing was the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we've had over the years from Wyden and Udall, I guess, to a certain extent, warnings that there was something happening that that if we knew about as the American public, we would be shocked. And at the time, he said this is the tip of the iceberg. Now, I know that this story that you just released via The Intercept is, if not the final reporting on these documents, but perhaps we're getting close to the end. Have we seen that iceberg? Are there things that Wyden was referring to that you think you may not have had access to through these Snowden documents? Or have we seen the iceberg?
No, we haven't seen the iceberg. I mean, I think this is a really important point. Sometimes people think that what Edward Snowden gave us is the entire files of the NSA, so that I now know everything the NSA is doing and I can just publish whatever I want to show what the NSA is doing. That's completely wrong. What Snowden gave us is a snippet, a snapshot of what the NSA does. Granted, there were a lot of documents in this archive, and there are actually a lot more stories to be published, if not by me, then by other journalists who we arranged to have access to the archive, which is one of the things we're working on. And there will be a lot more significant stories to come. But even if they were all out there, we still wouldn't know anything close to everything the NSA is doing. And this is, I think, a really important point. Snowden took what he could take, but he didn't have access to everything. He certainly didn't have access to all of the most sensitive material. In fact, most of the most sensitive material he probably didn't have access to. There are whole programs that are highly controversial that aren't included in the archive. And, you know, this is, I think, an important point about Ron Wyden and Mark Udall. Ran around the country for 3 years winking and hinting that there were all these things that we should know about, because if we knew about them, we would all be stunned and outraged and shocked about what they call these extremist theories that the Obama administration had adopted in secret about their own surveillance powers. And yet they completely lacked the courage ever to disclose what any of these things were, even though they had the power under the Constitution to go to the Senate floor and spill all of those secrets without any risk of prosecution. They have complete and full immunity as senators to go to the floor of the Senate and say whatever they want without being prosecuted, even revealing classified information. And it took Edward Snowden to have the courage to do what Ron Wyden and Mark Udall lacked the courage to do, which is go and tell us about these specific things, even though he didn't have the constitutional immunity as a member of Congress, and he's charged with multiple felonies and has had his whole life unraveled. So, you know, I'd like to know why it is that Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, who are so bothered by all of these abuses, don't fulfill their obligation as members of Congress and that the Constitution gave them, and go and inform the American people about what it is that they think we ought to know. I realize they might lose some standing in Washington. The Washington Post editorial board would probably condemn them. They might even lose their place on the Intelligence Committee. But if they really believe the things that they're saying, why don't they have 1/100th of the courage and principle of what Edward Snowden did and come forth and tell us? And I'm sure there are a lot of programs that are at least as disturbing, if not more disturbing, than the ones we've reported on that they know about, but we don't. And I hope that one day they will have those pangs of conscience that Edward Snowden had that led him to come forth and tell us about what it is that we should know, because there definitely are things that I don't know about and that aren't in the documents that are in their brains.
Okay, and you said that you were going to give other journalists access to the archives. How does that work? I mean, my understanding is that there's been a concern, the legal implications of you being a source versus a reporter on this, and certainly people have called for, at this point, you know, the release of all the documents. And I mean, how does that work, that you provide access the archives to other journalists?
Well, those are hard questions, and we're still figuring it out, and it's because we haven't quite figured it out yet that we haven't done it yet. But first of all, as far as this call for releasing all documents, it's just completely moronic. You know, when you're a journalist, you have a source, and they come forward and they say, this is what I insist upon in terms of how the material will be treated. And Edward Snowden was very clear, as I've said many times, as Bart Gellman has said many times, and as pretty much everybody else has said, he was quite clear that he didn't want all the material released. If he had wanted all that material released, he never would have come to us. He could have just uploaded those documents to the internet himself. He wouldn't have needed journalists to do that. He came to us because he wanted to vet all the material. But there are legal implications, and there are logistical implications to just taking the documents and handing them out to journalists around the world. You do become a source if you do that, and there are serious risks of criminal prosecution if you just start handing out top secret documents to journalists around the world. Also, you have to protect your source, and you want to make sure that the agreements you entered into with him about what wouldn't be published remain honored, even if you have other journalists working on it. So we're trying to create a system where we're not handing out the material to journalists around the world, but we're letting them come and research the archive, to work with the archive, to report on things, but can't just take things that we still maintain physical control over, and then we work with them as journalistic partners as they do the reporting that they think needs to be done on the remaining documents in the archive. So how that works logistically and legally and in terms of security are really complex questions that we're now working on figuring out, but I am absolutely committed to making sure that every last document in this archive that's in the public interest that should be reported is reported, and is reported as quickly as possible. And if that means significantly expanding the number of journalists who are able to work on it, then that's certainly what we're going to do.
So you haven't been able to basically vet every document at this point?
I've certainly looked at every document by now at least once, and usually more than once, but you know, a lot of these documents are really technologically complicated. You know, we've worked with technical experts as well, but because there's so many documents, you know, no one person or no group of 10 people will be able to find every story. I'm sure there's big stories that we've overlooked that other people who have other kinds of expertise will find. There's also documents pertaining to pretty much every country on the globe, and I'm sure journalists who understand those countries really well because they report there will be able to see things about those kinds of documents that we ourselves haven't seen. And that's why I've, you know, partnered with, I think, 20 news organizations around the world to do this reporting. But I'm certain that opening up even further will enable journalists to find all sorts of things that we just didn't see.
Glenn Greenwald, author of No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the Surveillance State, thanks so much for your time today. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, Sam. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. Just a reminder, it is your contributions to this program that make it possible. By becoming a member today, you ensure that we are able to do these programs on a daily basis. And this week, tomorrow, actually, Matt and Mike will be doing Matt and Mike Wednesday as opposed to Monday. I will be heading to Motown, as some people are known to have called Detroit. And I will be broadcasting live from Netroots Nation, also interviewing a lot of other people for the days and weeks ahead. If you're in Netroots, look for me, and I think I'll be in Radio Row. I'll probably be in the Ring of Fire booth. We're still doing Ring of Fire on the weekends. By all means, come up and say hi. I may be, if it's the middle of the live show, obviously I'm not going to be able to say hi. But if it's any time between, you know, after 1:30, when it gets time to write up to the beginning of the show, I also am a little bit frantic, and more so when we're remote. But certainly say hi. There's also a meetup, which Matt and Mike will give the information on tomorrow on the program. And we will be tweeting it out. We're doing a meetup, I think, with TYT and Pac-Man Show. Nobody has told me about it, but apparently it's happening. And yes, please don't hesitate coming up and saying hello. And if I'm rushed, I'm rushed.
Who does that Sam Cedar think he is, not signing me an autograph while he's doing live radio?
No, I will sign autographs during live radio. Last year, I think we interviewed Jeremo. Was it last year or the year before?
I think it was last year.
That was one of the highlights of my trip. The only interview I remember. And
no, Jeremo is an exception.
Yeah, of course. And so, folks, it is your membership. We're going to be doing. We got plans to expand this program. And to upgrade its in many different ways, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to do that. It may involve the fundraiser. There's a lot of other things, but the one thing that gives us confidence that we can continue is your memberships. So if you have the financial wherewithal and you enjoy this program, it is just pennies a day. Go to majority.fm, become a member today. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, you should be buying it through our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff, your Amazon stuff through that. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Or you can do it as a one-off every time you do you buy something on Amazon. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on that Amazon link. It'll take you to your Amazon page. Again, you'll notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's an employee-owned company, and all fair trade. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We will see you, or I'll be back Thursday live. Matt and Mike will be here tomorrow. Take it easy, folks.
Apple pale.